Welcome, members and guests, to the March 21st program of the City Club of Eugene. Welcome our TV audiences on community television and the Oregon Wind Network. I'm Mary Layton, president of City Club. Our sponsors today are Evans Elder Brown, Eugene Legal, legal solutions at an affordable price, PAC Info, internet solutions, and a special thank you to KLCC for airing the programs on Monday night and KPFF Consulting Engineers for our office space. We thank you for listening. These programs are free for our listening audience, yet there are costs involved. Your contribution is completely tax deductible and will help keep our organization healthy. Today's presenters are Scott Coltrane, Senior Vice President and Provost, University of Oregon, and Cheryl Collins, Vice President of Organizational Development, Ninkasi Brewing Company, who will discuss the value of a liberal arts education. What is the use of a BA in French history or the classics? A significant majority of all students enrolled at the University of Oregon are majoring in traditional liberal arts and science disciplines. In this program, Scott will explain why a great university should invest so much of our collective treasure in cultivating expertise in subjects like those. Cheryl Collins will follow up with a description of the appeal of liberal arts majors to a thriving company in a growing edge of the local economy. As provost, Scott Coltrane serves as the chief academic officer at the University of Oregon, fostering excellence in undergraduate education, graduate education, research, and service to Oregonians. After a stint as interim provost, Scott was chosen from a very competitive group of candidates in a national search. Coltrane previously served as dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Oregon, a job from which he was dragged kicking and screaming into the provost office. And as the Associate Dean of the College of Humanities, Arts, and Social Sciences at the University of California, Riverside. Considering that he's been fully engaged in administrative work for the last 10 years, his list of books and publications has continued to be impressive. His research is on family life, by the way, and fatherhood in particular. Cheryl Collins is the Vice President of Organizational Development at Ninkasi Brewing Company. At Ninkasi and in her previous jobs, she has helped recruit the most promising candidates, led training and leadership development activities, and helped advance strategic goals. She received the University of Oregon Recruiter of the Year Award and was recently featured in HR Magazine in a piece about best practices in small businesses. Cheryl's undergraduate degree majors were political science and history. Scott will now talk to us a little bit about why we shouldn't worry that we're spending so much personal and collective treasure on liberal arts majors.
Thank you, Mary, and thank you for inviting me to City Club. So my question is, what is a liberal arts education? To begin, let me give you some context and history about the topic and show you how it relates to education at the University of Oregon. In the modern context, liberal arts education refers to a curriculum that imparts general knowledge and develops a student's intellectual capabilities. This includes promoting students' capacity for analysis, for problem solving, communication, computation, and synthesis of knowledge. A liberal arts education is achieved through a study of the arts, literature, languages, philosophy, history, social science, mathematics, and natural sciences. Liberal arts education has been with us for quite some time. In classical antiquity, the liberal arts were those subjects or skills that were considered essential for a free person, a citizen, to know in order to take part in civic life. Hence, both the Greek and the Latin roots for liberal are based on the concept of freedom, and they underlie the terms liberty or liberate. So the concept is based on the notion that in a democracy, it depends on free individuals who have the knowledge and the skills to participate in active civic engagement. In ancient times, liberal arts subjects included grammar, rhetoric, and logic. In medieval times, fields were added: arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. If you look closely, that astronomy also included astrology. In the modern era, as the Academy expanded its knowledge base, the physical and natural sciences, along with the social sciences, were added to the subjects that were presumed to prepare individuals to succeed and, importantly, to contribute in meaningful ways to society. Because the University of Oregon was founded in 1876, we can see a transformation in the core liberal arts curriculum over the years. That's 150 years of experience. So today, we're an institution that continues to value, some might say even more greatly values, the liberal arts as the core to the university. And that's reflected in our curriculum. It's reflected in our academic plan. The academic plan states, and I quote, "We hold fast to a tradition of higher education that has prevailed in this nation since its very founding. A course of study that is rightly described as liberal because it prepares students for full participation as citizens in a free democratic society and enables the full development of human potential." The University of Oregon mission statement, it's a rather long statement, but the first part of it, I think, captures this very well. Our mission is that we will help students to, quote, question critically, think logically, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. Education is not just training. Education is not just promoting the acquisition of specific technical skills. It is teaching students the habits of mind, the ways of questioning, the ways of thinking that will lead to creative inquiry, and importantly, to problem solving. We need to prepare students to succeed in a wide range of careers, as well as to help them forge lives that are meaningful and that are rich with purpose. Today, as compared to 100 years ago, people are much less likely to hold the same job or stay in the same career for a lifetime. Many of our students will be required to hold jobs in 10 years that don't even exist today. New fields are emerging faster than ever before. Therefore, we need to prepare our students for a very rapidly changing environment. Rather than training students for a narrow line of work, we need to nurture the skills and adaptability that will prepare them to forge new solutions to challenges that we can't even yet imagine. There are problems to be solved that haven't even arisen yet. So how do we provide our students with that nimbleness of thought to be able to do that? Professional education and liberal arts education are often portrayed in opposition or seen as incompatible, but they are not. In fact, the professional schools at the University of Oregon have a great appreciation for the liberal arts core, as exemplified in our academic plan, in our admission statement, and in the ways that our curriculum is organized. This is typically, I'm used to using PowerPoint, where I would show a picture of Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple Computer, and in it, there are two street signs, and one of the street signs says Technology Way, and the other one says Liberal Arts Avenue. And that is, you know, Apple's claim to fame, how to capture that artistic, creative design features and also have technical expertise. And that's what liberal arts allows us to do. We have five strong professional schools and colleges at the University of Oregon, but most of the liberal arts majors are offered through our College of Arts and Sciences. A large number of our students double or even triple major, and that's not true of a lot of large universities. The arts and sciences majors are among the most popular at the University of Oregon. We have 1,000 or more majors in fields like psychology, human physiology, economics, and biology. We have in the neighborhood of 500 majors in political science, sociology, general social sciences, environmental studies, English, and romance languages. We have about 300 or 400 majors in history, anthropology, chemistry, and mathematics. We have 100 or 200 majors in fields like cinema studies, East Asian languages and literatures, linguistics, philosophy, theater arts, general science, physics, geology, geography, and international studies. And many smaller majors also offer degrees in the humanities and the social sciences, but in smaller programmatic fashion. Why does this matter? Why do we continue to teach these kind of fundamental basic disciplines? Well, I think it's important to say it's still very important for practical success in jobs. According to a recent national survey of over 300 executives in private sector companies and nonprofit organizations, employers look for more than someone who's specially trained in a field when they consider recent college graduates for jobs. 93% of those surveyed agreed that, quote, a candidate's demonstrated capacity to think critically, communicate clearly, and solve complex problems is more important than their undergraduate major. 4 out of 5 employers said that each college graduate should have a broad knowledge in the liberal arts and sciences, and 3 out of 4 would recommend a liberal education for their own children. Laszlo Bock, who is the senior vice president of people operations for Google, in other words, the guy who's in charge of hiring for one of the world's most successful new companies, was interviewed by a journalist just last month, and he said, quote, for every job, the number one thing we look for is general cognitive ability. And it's not IQ, it's learning ability. It's the ability to process on the fly. It's the ability to pull together disparate bits of information. Back to the national survey, employers want candidates with the following skills: the ability to communicate verbally and in writing with persons inside and outside the organization, the ability to work in a team structure, the ability to make decisions and solve problems, the ability to plan, organize, and prioritize, the ability to obtain and process information, and the ability to analyze quantitative data. Sounds like a liberal arts education to me. In addition, more than 9 in 10 of those employers surveyed said it's also important that they hire, that who they hire demonstrate ethical judgment, integrity, intercultural skills, and the capacity for continued new learning. And that may be the key, the capacity for continued new learning. These are exactly the skills that a liberal arts and sciences education provides. That is what we strive for to provide in the core curriculum at the University of Oregon. Some recent surveys, and you may have seen this in the newspaper, show that humanities in particular graduates and sometimes social science graduates, I know that anthropology got picked on in one I saw just a couple of months ago, earn less immediately out of college. So there's several surveys, and maybe during the question period, the director of our career center here, Daniel, can answer a little more data. He just found some last night. But the fact that people start a little bit lower right out of the gate does not mean they don't earn more later. When we follow these individuals through their careers, 30 years later, they earn more than those trained in more technical fields. This is not true of all fields, but by and large, liberal arts majors start low, but in the end, they overtake the rest of the world. And for science graduates, the contrast is even greater. They start earning about the same as other liberal arts graduates, but end up earning about 30% more than those who have professional degrees. So incorporating the big picture and taking the long view, it's more important to get a solid liberal arts education than to get narrow skills training. But how do they get jobs? Where do liberal arts and sciences majors end up? So again, we surveyed employers, not we, but the national association surveyed, and the jobs into which liberal arts and sciences graduates are hired include, and these are the top ones, educators and professors, lawyers and judges, managers, chief executives and legislators, social workers, counselors, and clergy, sales and marketing professionals, and finally, administrators, accountants, and auditors. In addition, liberal arts and sciences majors are more likely than others to go on to earn graduate degrees. Daniel was just telling me something on the order of 20% of our graduating class in liberal arts and sciences last year went on to some advanced study. Those people who do go on to graduate school end up making more than others. They achieve higher earnings later in their careers. So we know that attending college and majoring in the liberal arts and sciences is a great investment for an individual career. But what we need to remember is that it's also an investment in the future of our communities, in the future of our nation, and frankly, for global survival. What kinds of educational practices will prepare college graduates to get things done in the world? Our global economy demands innovation, technological savvy, entrepreneurship, risk-taking. We must teach our students to critically evaluate the quality of information and convert this information into knowledge and action. We must help students learn to solve problems effectively in collaboration with people from very different backgrounds and cultures. We must teach students to combine entrepreneurial creativity and technological know-how with humanistic vision and values. This is accomplished through a liberal arts education. Making a liberal arts education available to the broadest range of students is a high priority for the University of Oregon. A few years ago, we started a program called Pathway Oregon. This program is intended for low-income students, Oregonians, who in many cases are the first from their families to apply to college. Students who qualify for Pathway Oregon attend the UO tuition-free. The university covers all the tuition costs not picked up by federal and state financial aid, and in some cases also provides room and board. All Pathway Oregon students receive personal guidance from an advisor who helps them settle into the university, reach achievement goals, and ultimately launch careers. The vast majority of these students end up in foundational liberal arts studies. So, to reiterate, our mission statement says that we will help students learn to question critically, think logically, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. In the College of Arts and Sciences, a few years ago we surveyed our graduates to see where their career trajectories of liberal arts majors took them. We presented this information to our students in forums that are organized through the Career Center in the library called So You Want My Job. And that's where I first met Cheryl, and I met her boss, who was a sociology major, Jamie Floyd, who found one of the founders of NNCASI. And Cheryl will talk to you in a few minutes about the ways in which liberal arts folks end up being good beer makers. In this web survey, what we did was we asked people, and it was open-ended, and what we said was, where are you now? What do you do? You know, what's your job? And then the basic question was, did you anticipate that you would end up in the job you now hold? For the most part, people said no. Very few followed a path prescribed by their major. Instead, they followed winding paths that they could not have anticipated. So I can't give you all the examples, but let me just summarize a few. Political science alums, particularly political science majors over the year. One was an interpreter at the Swiss Parliament. One, a CIA intelligence officer. High-ranking executives at Intel, Google, and Facebook. So tech jobs, basically, coming out of political science. History graduates who founded data companies or ended up working in communications and technology companies. English alumni doing a wide variety of jobs, including one who's an oral surgeon. One was the founder of a company that markets radar simulators, not what you'd normally think of as an English grad. A Russian studies alum who's now the city attorney for Minneapolis. Theater alums who produce documentary films, others who work in fundraising and development, not to mention a few who still wait tables. Biology and geography graduates who manage sustainable wineries, and others who created companies that develop green buildings or other products. Psychology alums who work in IT security, marketing, and social media. Most have been amazingly successful in jobs they never would have anticipated, and most gave credit to their liberal arts education for giving them the experience, skills, and vision that allowed them to think for themselves and allowed them to be successful in the work world. So with that, I will turn it over to Cheryl, who will give us more personal stories.
I am I'm not as tall. Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate being able to come and share our story and talk a little bit about Ninkasi. And that was actually a great segue, talking a little bit about the political science degree. That was my undergraduate degree. And so one question I usually get is, so you're vice president of organizational development at Ninkasi. I'm like, yep, political science major. That seems to be a clear transition, right? And most people don't see the connection, but there definitely is one there. Talking about myself personally and how my liberal arts education provided value in my career, I think back to my first class at University of Oregon, and I was the first person in my immediate family to go to college. I felt very unprepared. I didn't really know what I was getting myself into, and I remember sitting in my first history class, and it was an hour-long lecture. And the professor started talking, and I'm just sitting there waiting to get a handout or some kind of notes or something to hold my hand, really, and in the process. And about an hour went by, and he's like, all right, class dismissed. And I sat there, and I left with nothing written down. I didn't know what I was doing. And I'm looking around going, okay, is this it? Do I just sit here and, you know, listen to somebody talk about something? I'm really confused. So I talked to some classmates, and they're like, no, you got to take notes. So I started taking notes, and my notes were just one big paragraph. They were horrible. They were not organized. They didn't make any sense. And come time to study for a test, it was a challenge. But I started working with the professors. I worked with my career counselor or my counselors at the college. You know, did the study groups, things they recommended. And I think back to that first class and to where I was at my last class upon graduation, much more organized, much more prepared. I understood how to decipher what a professor was saying and turn it into something tangible that I could use in my education. And I think about other things throughout the process. You think a lot of classes provide you with experiences such as you're going to do group projects. And a lot of people, when you're in school, you find group projects can be sometimes fun, but sometimes frustrating. The rule of order seems to be one person does most of the work, one person does usually nothing, and there's some people who kind of float along in the middle. And then in addition to that, you come through and you encounter problems. You have to work with people and different personalities. You know, all these challenges that you encounter, and on top of that, you're learning all of these fun, interesting things. So upon graduation, and I started my first job, a couple years into it, when I was I had just gotten into management, and I had asked somebody, you know, hey, I have my political science degree. Is that going to hold me back not having a business degree? And one thing this person said, and I love how she framed it, she said, you have a business degree, you just don't realize it, because in politics, really the difference just replaced people with countries, and it's virtually the same thing. And it's true. I think about a lot of the political theory classes that I took and how it taught me about how people interact with each other. And then it occurred to me when we were having a meeting one day about better our recruitment from the University of Oregon. And really what it was is that the degree was almost irrelevant. I mean, liberal arts education is fantastic, but I think back to all the skills that I was just sharing with you. I learned how to sit in a meeting, and I learned how to listen to people, and I learned how to identify the key talking points. I learned how to solve problems. I learned how to work in a group, because how many of us in any business, working with people is a fundamental part. Especially at Ninkasi, we were actually just having this conversation about a week ago about who we hire and what we're looking for. And we see ourselves at Ninkasi as not so much as a family, but as a community. And if you think about what it means to be a member of a community, it means to show up, participate, work well with each other, be respectful of each other, come to the table with creative solutions and how to solve problems. That's what we want. And really, the best experience you're going to get doing that is in college. I mean, that's exactly what that is modeling and teaching us in college. And the other thing that I am a huge advocate of recruiting out of the university is because for me personally, I learned how to learn in college. I mean, you think in high school, it's not quite the same. But in college, you know, you really have a lot of independence and you can make of it what you want. But really, that's what college and my education provided to me in my career is it taught me how to learn. And I was able to take all of those things and work in many different, you know, fields. I think you referenced not having the same job once upon graduation. I've worked at three different companies, and I think I've had 9 different jobs. It's provided me just an array of experiences, and how many doors have been opened for me because of my education is just priceless. And I think back to when I was trying to make that decision in my life of, do I stay and work or do I go to school? I would not be where I am today without my education. That is an absolute guarantee. On the flip side, turning it back into how we recruit and why we recruit from the liberal arts field is very similar to what I was just sharing with you. That's what we're looking for. We're looking for people who know how to, you know, solve problems, work in teams, be an effective member of a community. And so in every job that I've had with recruitment, I very much value my relationship with the University of Oregon and everything that they have done to help us and provide us with great talent. We are fortunate to be a fast-growing company in a town that has a wonderful university right down the street, and I think every business needs to have a partnership with the university. The majority of incoming people that we hire for our Eugene admin office here at the brewery are from University of Oregon. They're straight out, and actually one story that I wanted to share with you today was that I actually received a phone call from a professor. That's something that I have found valuable, is keeping in touch with not just the Career Center, but also former professors and making an appearance wherever I can at the university. But we had a social media position that we were hiring for. It was the first time. Now, social media is a challenging one to recruit for because there's not a lot of experience. This is a brand new field. There's concentrations in it, but there's not majors in it, and it's changing. It seems like every day there's a new social media platform out there, and quite frankly, we all felt too old to really understand what was going on in the social media world, so we're like, we need somebody who just gets it. We don't know where they're going to come from or what they're going to look like, but we need somebody who gets it. And sure enough, we thought, okay, well, we're just going to put it out here on Facebook and see what happens. And we actually had a professor contact us and say, hey, I have a student who you would absolutely just adore. She's fantastic, and I think she would do great at this job. She doesn't have any work experience, though. We're like, okay, well, that's okay. You know, it's social media. So, you know, we'll, let's bring her in. And we had probably more than 150 applications for this position. And, you know, she came in, she was prepared. She actually went ahead and did research on other social media that bigger breweries were doing. And she presented a presentation to us. And she even said, this is just what I would have done in school, what I learned at U of O. So she came in and said, you know, here's what other breweries are doing. Here's what's working. Here's what isn't. And then during our interview process, we typically have them prepare something, a presentation of some kind. Sure enough, anybody who's coming to us in the interview process with an education or with a college education, they know how to give better presentations because they're usually expected to do that within their college curriculum. But she did a fantastic job with all of that, and just her enthusiasm and everything she came prepared, you wouldn't have known she had zero work experience. I think she was a waitress for like 6 months somewhere. But it was how she presented herself in the interview, and she ended up getting the job, and she was very excited. And about 8 months later, she was promoted to managing one of our donations programs, which was great for her because she's from California, and that's where the position is. And so it was just a wonderful experience, and that was, she's a great example of how your education speaks volumes for you. And while work experience is fantastic, because we are looking for people who bring work experience to the table, you can't replace the value of an education, of a college education. And I know for myself and for what I've seen with other people at Ninkasi, the liberal arts school does a fantastic job training people and providing them the skills that they need to make them attractive candidates that we like hiring. So, thank you.
Thank you, Cheryl Collins and Scott Coltrane. Now it's time for our members and guests to form tables at their questions. So we'll take a break of a few minutes.
You're listening to KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, at 88.1 KLBR Bend, KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and on the web, klcc.org.
On March 21st, our guest speakers are Scott Coltrane, Senior Vice President and Provost, University of Oregon, and Cheryl Collins, Vice President of Organizational Development, Ninkasi Brewing Company. And now, time for our members' questions.
My name is Arnold Ismack. I've been a City Club member for 16 years, I'm afraid. But my question is for Scott Coltrane. You told us about all the great qualities of a liberal arts education, but you didn't mention one thing that's going on these days at the University of Oregon and at most universities nationwide, and that is the switch to a heavy number of part-time adjunct instructors. And it's obvious that that's been done to save money, since they get paid very little. What is the move to adjunct instructors doing to the quality of education in the college?
Thank you. So this is Scott Coltrane. I think Arnold is referring, for our case here at University of Oregon, to the fact that our student body grew by about 20%. So we took 4,000 more students over the last 6 years. And in order to accommodate them, we hired people who are not always tenure-related instructors, but many of them are career teachers and instructors. So I wouldn't say that the assumption is that they're not as good in the classroom. In fact, many of them are some of our best teachers. But we're also in the middle of implementing a collective bargaining agreement where we have different categories of faculty. The tenure-related faculty are expected to do research, to teach, and to do service to the university. There is a career non-tenure track set of faculty who do instruction and other kinds of contributions to the students. Those particularly were advantaged through collective bargaining, where the salaries have now, there's floors for all of them. They have longer term contracts. We're really quite more competitive on a national level. So in some ways, we're moving toward a more secure base for those, some of our best instructors. And then we have adjuncts, too, that we rely on. There are some faculty. Eugene is a great area for attracting very well-educated population. We have people from have PhDs from Ivies, from Berkeley, who want to teach for us, but they only want to teach one or two courses. And so they are in that adjunct quality, but they're a huge enriching benefit to the university. And many of them are just fantastic in the classroom. So, but one of the things we're doing is we're hiring more tenure-related faculty because our membership in the AAU, our research productivity, is dependent upon having many productive faculty. The way that most flagship universities do that is by beefing up the number of tenure-related faculty. So we're transitioning some of those adjuncts and career into hiring more tenure-related faculty. It takes a while to do that.
Hey, I'm John Anik, a City Club member, also a political science and history major. And the question we have is, what do you folks see are the potential effects of social media on liberal arts education?
All right, this is Cheryl Collins. You know, I think it's going to have a profound effect on it. Social media is not a fad. It's not something going away. It's actually changed how we interact with each other. We talk a lot about different generations in the workplace. This is the first time, and I don't know how long, we have four generations in the workplace. Millennials are a big part of that, and they're not going away. They're only coming in mass even more. So social media, for us, I know it's become a huge part of our business. It's an aspect on how we move forward. It's how we communicate in the most, it's the most effective channel on how we communicate with our partners and our customers. So social media, I think, is going to have a profound impact. And, you know, it would be nice from a business standpoint. You do see more and more education coming behind it and formalizing the training people are receiving with social media.
So for the University of Oregon, we are incorporating social media, obviously, in our outreach and admission process. We have new academic programs that take account of it. We have a new graduate certificate in new media and culture, which is joint between architecture and allied arts and journalism and arts and sciences. And we're able to communicate with our students because they come in tech ready. They know how to use social media and they know how to use all the gadgets. And so what we're doing is incorporating that into how we create communities. So it isn't just about living in a dormitory together. It's about connecting through, you know, cyberspace. And so we're incorporating that in the way we advise students and make sure they stay on track.
Bob Cassidy, City Club member, a sociology major. You didn't mention the Department of Sociology. My question is for Carol. The hiring of people, you're looking for people who can solve problems, and other than having a college education, how does your firm sort out people who would be good problem solvers?
Great question. This is Cheryl. A big part of it is through our interview process. It actually takes us about 6 to 8 weeks to fill a position. Part of that is we do a lot of one-on-one interviews, and then we typically give somebody a problem-solving activity to demonstrate during a panel interview. So that could range, like, for instance, social media. It was how would you generate, give me an example of a campaign you would create that would attract 100,000 more Facebook user or Facebook connections with our page. So we do that in every single position. There's some project that you have to take part of, and it typically demonstrates problem-solving skills.
Thank you. Dan Solitz, City Club 2009. Our table was wondering what a liberal arts education contributes to quality of life or happiness. There's been, Mary, a lot of surveys done lately about which country is the happiest country. Has there been any surveys or empirical data on how a liberal arts education leads to a happier life? I mean, does anybody die saying, gee, I wish I'd went to college more and majored in technology?
I'll take a first cut on that one. This is Scott Coltrane. I think one of the things that a humanities curriculum in particular does is it has students and people engage with what matters in life, what gives value to life. And those are things that particularly the normal college-age student really needs to grapple with. Those are the huge issues, or a philosophy class. These are the things that we need to do. What matters in life, and what are we doing here? These are profound questions that I think sometimes if students are so focused on making a buck or getting technical training that they ignore. I think that's one of the values of being in a place like Eugene at the University of Oregon, where we're really focused on having people engage. What does it mean to be ethical? What does it mean to help others?
Randy Prince, City Club member and graduate in history from U of O. A question from our table: how does athletics fit into this liberal arts curriculum and the university's mission statement? You know, usually people say, oh, that brings all the money in. But a lot of newspaper reports are saying that somehow the university forgot to buy enough classrooms, provide for enough student housing, provide adequate salaries for the non-tenured, didn't even cover the physical fitness facilities, the student rec center. So this funding argument I'm a little skeptical of. Community building, we always look at sports for that. Do you feel that the intercollegiate sports programs model teamwork, personal fitness and ethics, and the values of the institution in general? Or are they a distraction? And for the person in the private sector, how do you look at person with a lot of sports background? Because you've told us how you look at liberal arts.
So this is Scott Coltrane again. One of the things that's going on right now is we have a couple of huge cranes on campus. It's always nice to see that there is development. Our student recreation center is getting a large addition. Most of the athletics that goes on campus is not competitive sports on a national level, but it's student recreation. We have overflowing capacity. Students are in the rec center all the time, and they're doing intramural sports. They're doing other just kind of skill building. Interestingly enough, when I went back over the curriculum of what was required of students, if you go back to the turn of the century, there were physical exercise, personal hygiene, religion. There were many parts of the curriculum that we sometimes define as outside of the curricular now that we felt was part of building the whole individual. Training for life, and that goes back to that kind of citizenship. Competitive athletics, I think, is something that our undergraduates by and large value, having that. I think it's part of having rituals and identifying emotionally with the campus. And the other thing is that our athletics department is self-supporting. All those scholarship athletes are actually pouring money into the academic side because the scholarships are paid for. A lot of other places don't do that. They subsidize or give that tuition free. So I think we benefit from athletics on many levels.
And then this is Cheryl. I would chime in on the private sector piece of that is sports teaches you team. You can't do anything in the business world without knowing how to work effectively on a team. On top of that, there's strategies that need to be learned. There's plays that need to be executed, and you're firing at all cylinders. We use sports as a huge analogy in business with what we're trying to create and what we're trying to do all of the time.
Mary Allison, City Club member and a psychology major many decades ago. And my questions for either one of you, in listening to both of you speak about the skills and attributes that a liberal arts degree brings to the workforce and to prospective employers, we were thinking about is, and have you seen this, is there a disconnect between those skills and attributes in what standardized testing tests children for now?
So this is Scott Coltrane. Standardized testing in the K-12 system, of course, has been part of a lot of controversies about whether those performance, you should tie teachers' salaries or funding for schools to it. In higher education, there's a different set of things. So we're engaged in, for accreditation purposes and other things, looking at learning outcomes. So we're evaluating what are we trying to teach, how do we measure what we're teaching. It's a different set of questions. It's a different set of testing. So it isn't the multiple choice test. It's having to really grapple with the concepts, to build arguments, to have analytical skills. So we're looking at different ways of doing that. There's a college learning assessment groups nationwide. I think that there's a tendency to want to have a shorthand answer on how we're doing and to evaluate from the outside. I think we, as a higher institution of higher learning, need to be out in front of those arguments and talk about what's the value added and what we're trying to teach, what we want our students to walk away with. So we're getting better at testing that, but it isn't the multiple choice variety.
Stu Thomas, City Club member, not a U of O graduate, but I was on the faculty for a number of years. The question from our table has to do with the number of liberal arts students and graduates over the years. Is it on the increase or decreasing? Scott, the way you define a liberal arts graduate includes, for example, a chemistry major or something like that, and that's, in my mind, not the traditional way of defining that person. Yeah.
So actually, sciences are part of a liberal education, and sciences can be technical fields, so usually it's between vocational versus disciplinary-based. And since we don't have a lot of applied disciplines at the University of Oregon, some of our more technical fields are, in fact, in those pure disciplines, the sciences, the social sciences. I'd say the trending over the last 5 or 10 years, more students have gone into STEM fields, like you say, so into the sciences and computer science. We've seen increased student credit hours and a slightly lower increase in the number of majors in the sciences and a slight dip in humanities, so languages, literatures. But the University of Oregon is a very traditional campus in that we require 2 years of language for anyone who gets a BA and a full year of college-level math, so calculus for anybody who gets a BS. Many of our sister institutions have moved away from that, and we think that it's very important to kind of, you know, hold on to those core values. So a little bit trending toward journalism, business, architecture, other applied vocational degrees. Many of those folks, though, double major. So they, you know, a great combination would be journalism and Spanish. We have an increasing number of that kind of pathway.
Jane Smith, member of City Club for a number of years. I attended the University of Hawaii and graduated from the University of Maine with a Bachelor of Science degree and a master's degree that didn't remotely relate to what I eventually ended up with. My degree is in social work, and I was 20 years in the banking industry, how you figure. I'm interested in what might affect a dip in students being humanities, interested in the humanities. And I wondered whether the specter of the huge indebtedness with only a vague idea of where the job prospects were might influence it. I'm also wondering whether the move from being a publicly funded institution to a privately funded institution, as with UO, has an effect, because the donors will be from the business arena, and what we hear about is the money pouring into sports, not pouring into anything else, although somebody's building all those other buildings, so, but that's vaguer in the public mind. And does the businessman providing a scholarship want to be assured that that student has the technical skills and the business skills or the humanity skills? If you can roll that up. Thanks.
Sure. Scott Coltrane again. I think that we are fundamentally and basically a public institution and always will be. The fact that the state has disinvested in higher education is quite alarming for us, and so we seek private funds, but we're still fundamentally a public institution. About 5% of our operating costs come from the state of Oregon. This year, that funding has gone up, and we're certainly, with a new institutional board, focusing on how we can partner with the state to have them invest more. They own the land and the buildings. They have a commitment to that. And so I don't think that we have given up any authority over the public mission that we hold, which is to serve the students of Oregon and the people of Oregon, to develop industry and the economy in ways that we can. And that's done through a combination now of tuition and private giving. The amount of giving to athletics is large, but the amount of giving to academics is also quite large. We're about to enter a campaign where we will raise over $1 billion, most of it for the academic side of the house.
Hi, I'm Marlene Nesri, City Club member for a while. And I did a student design major in art and politics many decades ago. I'm not from the U of O. I'm interested, you know, historically, you talked about how historically the liberal arts education was focused on preparation for citizenship. And given the fact that, you know, the economics of education, which you've just been talking about, these days, and the push by forces like the Oregon Education Investment Board toward measurable outcomes that don't really speak to the effect on citizenship of a liberal arts education, how are you now looking at that as an outcome of liberal arts education? How do you measure the effects on citizenship of a good liberal arts education these days?
Well, that's a good question. We are just developing metrics on how we can look at the success of our graduates, and we need to survey better over a longer period of time. And for instance, the earnings data, sometimes it takes 20 or 30 years of an accumulated career before you see the payoff. One of the things that we see is the civic engagement of our faculty, our faculty also, but of our students. We have one of the highest Teach for America participation rates of our graduating seniors, of Peace Corps, those sorts of alternative spring break where we go do various service learning projects. So we have students who want to change the world. I think we are a place that really values that. The slip I made about faculty, I think, maybe was appropriate because our faculty are very committed. They come here for quality of life and because they want to make the world a better place, and they impart those values to the students, not of one political persuasion. We have lots of vigorous arguments going from the most conservative to the most liberal, but the students engage those, and they talk about those, and they want to learn about those, and sometimes naively, but they really want to change the world, and it's our job to help them to ask the right questions and to figure out the ways they can apply themselves, both to be successful, to pay back whatever loans they had to take out, and for us to limit those loans. I mean, I think that was a good point. We really can't let tuition continue to go up. We have to get a handle on that. That's something we're aware of.
Rob Zago, City Club member, and I guess I'm supposed to give my pedigree. I majored in math and minored in music and have a doctorate in theoretical physics. But currently work as a research associate for the UO Sustainable Cities Initiative, so very much support the idea of a liberal education as a gateway to doing lots of great things. My question is about connecting the dots, and as a practical matter, faculty tend to be vigorously independent and resist efforts to tell them what to do in the classroom. So can you just give us a little insight into how the university's mission and values for liberal education get translated and implemented into what happens in the classroom, how faculty are engaged in that and are fulfilling that mission, that purpose?
So as an institution of higher learning and as a flagship AAU institution, we trust our faculty. The faculty are responsible for creating the curriculum. They are extremely intelligent and well-trained, and they bring to us the skills of being able to figure out what they should be teaching, what they should be researching. So we trust them. It's fundamentally a democratic process. By the same token, we need to make sure that our students come out with the right skills and awareness, and so we have various general education requirements. We're right now looking at our gen ed requirements and whether we have the right mix of things and whether those are related to each other. So, for instance, we have freshman interest groups for the incoming students where we'll take our physics instructors who maybe are teaching about the physics of music with our music instructors, and together they'll pair those courses. So it's the kind of top-down things we do are to facilitate those kinds of collaborations. We're just now embarking on a cluster hiring of faculty that are basically interdisciplinary in nature, where we provide some incentives to nudge those faculty and their smart ideas to coalesce in new ways. So we feel it's our responsibility to scaffold and support our great faculty.
Mary Layton, I'm going to bring forward a couple of questions from last week. Last week we heard from Collaborative Corvallis about initiatives that emerged from the office of the vice president of the university and engaged the community in a series of problem-solving sessions over several years, actually, addressing some of the issues that always arise, I imagine, between big universities and small communities. So two questions in particular that, if you don't have an answer to, perhaps you could think about. One is about a point they made that particularly caught my attention because I'm elementary teaching, that a student who breaks the rules, the college code of conduct off campus in Corvallis is soon to be treated in the same way that a student who breaks the rules on campus, that if you're a student at OSU and you do something you're not supposed to do, wherever you are, you'll receive consequences. Is that in the works or in any way on your horizon?
Sure. So we have in our community relations, and a couple of Karen Hyatt and Matt Roberts are here today with us, and I'm sure they'd like to be invited back to talk about this stuff at a full dedicated session. But yes, we're working on those things. We're organized a little bit different than Oregon State, but we're certainly looking at those proposals for on-campus, off-campus enforcements of the same kind of code of conduct, sphere of influence, and cooperating with the neighborhood associations.
Cool. And the second one is, do you have anything like that? It just seems hard to believe that here in the neighborhood where we'd have seven committees on two problems, in Eugene, that is, that we're not doing something, but are there ongoing collaborative activities sort of to foresee or to respond to issues that arise in clashes between the community and the university?
Sure. So there's outreach efforts that happen at the beginning of every fall where we're training our students about their neighbors and the neighbors about the students' needs and working together to make that as smooth as possible. And we organize those efforts through various bodies.
Okay. Well, I just felt as a you know, I'm a sociology major too, but I got my graduate degree from Oregon. And I'm thinking, well, wait, aren't we doing anything here? So we're interested in because these are issues that concern us all, and we'd like to have a solution, not a problem. So, yeah, let us know.
we'd love to collaborate.
Okay. So thank you, Scott Coltrane and Cheryl Collins, for bringing clarity and vision to our conversation about what good is a liberal arts education, where might you get to in life. And it's been very enlightening having you on the subject. Let's show them our appreciation. Thanks again to today's sponsors, Evans, Elder & Brown, Eugene Legal, and PAC Info. We meet again next Friday on March 28th at the Downtown Athletic Club to learn about World War II conscientious objectors on the Oregon coast and the seeds of the 60s. Lunches for this program can be ordered on City Club's website or by contacting the office. The simple lunch of soup and salad has been so popular, we will continue to offer it for those who prefer something lighter or who decide to join us at the last minute. Before we sign off, I'd like to recognize the passing of a former active member, Tony Nathan, who died recently. Tony was never quiet about anything. She had very decided opinions. I read in the paper, I think today, about how she was a housewife with certain ideas and got caught up and ended up to be nominated for the vice presidency. So I am asking not for a moment of silence, but for more moments of activism, particularly from those who have not been active. We have interesting campaigns coming up, and in one of them, someone who is mostly famous for being an engineering housewife is competing against someone who's already in office. So let us band together to support more people like Toni and honor her with moments of activism.